You know that feeling? You're looking at stock market news, just this flood of tickers, reports, opinions, and you just feel like completely swamped, drowning in info, but not really getting it.
Oh yeah, it's super common. So much data flying around, it's tough to figure out what actually matters.
Right. So, welcome to the deep dive. This is where we try to cut through all that noise. We grab some sources, dig in, and pull out the stuff that might actually, help. And today we're diving into this book from 2002, Stock Market Strategies That Work.
And our goal here, it's pretty simple, really. We want to give you a clearer picture of how the market works, based on what's in this book, and maybe arm you with some strategies that, well, have some staying power.
Yeah, not just chasing the latest fad.
Exactly. We're talking core principles. We'll look at how the book suggests thinking about the market, different ways to pick stocks, what your broker's role is, and some key ideas for everyone, whether you're just starting or you've been at it a while.
Okay, let's get into it. The authors, they had a pretty specific take on the market, didn't they? Especially for like the little guy.
They really did. They saw it as, frankly, a dangerous place if you didn't have the right tools or knowledge. They had this memorable analogy. They called small investors market monkeys, sort of vulnerable to the bigger players, the lions and tigers, and also vulnerable to just doing what everyone else is doing, that herd mentality
Herd
thing.
mentality, right? Always dangerous.
So their goal was basically to help these market monkeys become smarter, more strategic market chimps.
Market chimps. I like that. Agile, clever, navigating the jungle a bit better. Okay. And one of the first things these chimps needed to understand, according to the book, was something they called the big lie. What was that?
The big lie. Basically, it was the idea that if you just focus on a company's fundamentals, how healthy it looks financially, its earnings, assets, all that.
That's the path to profit.
Right. That alone guarantees profit. But their argument was, look, if fundamentals were everything, then why do even really well-run mutual funds bounce around so much in price?
Good point. Those fluctuations suggest something else is going on.
Exactly. They argued it showed other forces were at play beyond just the company's books.
So, if it's not only about the fundamentals, what's the main game here? What's the goal in this kind of market?
Well, they were pretty blunt about it. The main goal, whether you're trading or investing, is profit. Simple as that. Making money. Sure, there are other things, but that's the core driver. And they also pointed out that the market itself had changed in ways that made this focus even stronger.
What kind of changes were they seeing back then around 2002?
They talked about a big increase in volatility starting around the mid-80s. Price moves that used to take months could suddenly happen in like days or even within one day.
Wow, much faster pace.
Yeah, exactly. And that faster pace really fueled the rise of active trading, day trading, people trying to jump on those short-term swings.
Which really highlights the difference between a trader and a long-term investor, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just about how long you hold something. The book pointed out key differences, things like taxes. Long-term investing usually gets better tax treatment, but successful trading, could potentially bring in bigger returns faster, maybe enough to offset the higher taxes. But trading usually takes way more active involvement, more time watching, more decisions.
Makes sense. Okay, let's talk practicalities. Getting started, what kind of money, what kind of risk capital did the book say you needed back then?
Well, the minimum to just open an account was often around $500. They stressed this, starting with only $500 really limited your options, your strategies.
Okay, so say you have that $500. What did they recommend doing with it? What's the smart move?
Their main suggestion for that amount was mutual funds.
Why mutual funds?
Because you get instant diversification. You're spread across lots of stocks right away. Plus, you get professional managers looking after it.
Right, you're not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Exactly. And while you can trade mutual funds, they really saw them as better for the long haul. Let that diversification and professional management work over time. Even today, thinking about index funds versus sector funds, diversification is still key, especially with smaller amounts.
Okay. What if you scrape together a bit more, say $1,000?
So $1,000 gives you a little more wiggle room. You could maybe buy 100 shares of a $10 stock. But again, they warned against putting it all in one place. One bad news story could wipe out a big chunk.
Still risky.
So mutual funds were still a good option. Or they suggested maybe buying odd lots.
Odd lots. What are those?
Fewer than 100 shares. So instead of 100 shares of one stock, maybe you buy like 20 shares of five different stocks. still diversifying, just in smaller pieces.
Gotcha. Now, the book made a point about $3,000 being a more significant starting point. Why was that amount better for these market chimps?
Right, $3,000. According to them, that opened up more possibilities. First, it just gives you more of a cushion. If you lose a little bit early on, it doesn't sting quite as much psychologically as losing a chunk of $500.
Yeah, that makes sense. Less pressure.
And it gives you more strategic flexibility. Maybe you're looking at a strategy where the stock might dip a bit before it goes up. $3,000 gives you more room for that. And crucially, back then, having over $2,000 often meant you could trade on 50% margin with many brokers.
Margin trading. Okay, explain that again.
It basically means borrowing money from your broker to trade with. So if you have $3,000, you could potentially trade with $6,000. Doubles your buying power.
Sounds powerful, but risky.
Very risky, because it doubles your losses too. And you pay interest on the borrowed money. We'll definitely talk more about margin later. It's a big topic.
Okay, definitely need to circle back to margin. But before that, information. We're just swimming in it today, right? News 24/7, endless online chatter. How did the book advise dealing with all that information?
Their advice was really clear. Focus on facts, not opinions.
Facts, not opinions.
They weren't saying ignore everything, but you need to look critically at where the information comes from and what kind of information it is. They were especially wary of, like, insider tips or big pronouncements from analysts or company bosses.
Because they might have their own agenda.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They often have a vested interest in pushing things a certain way.
So how do you tell the difference? What's a fact versus an opinion in this context?
Well, they define an opinion as basically anything someone says that isn't guaranteed to happen. So predictions, interpretations, that's opinion.
Like analysts buy-sell ratings?
Yeah, or company officers talking up their stock, newsletter writers wanting subscribers, industry folks promoting their sector, even government officials maybe spinning things. That's all opinion, potentially biased.
And facts are?
Facts are verifiable data. Sales numbers, stuff in official company reports, government stats, earnings announcements, hard data.
But even facts can be spun, right?
Oh, for sure. They warned about spin, where maybe only the good data gets highlighted. The key is to look for trends over time, get info from different places, and then form your own view. Don't just take one source's word for it.
Good advice then. Good advice now. Okay, let's shift to actually playing the game, the mechanics. What's the basic building block here?
It's the share. A share is just a little piece of ownership in a company that's publicly traded.
Okay. And they're priced in dollars per share.
Right. And while you can buy just one share, the standard trading unit is called a lot, which is 100 shares.
And anything less than 100 is?
That's an odd lot, like we talked about for smaller investments.
Got it. And how do these shares get out there for us to buy in the first place when a company starts out?
That happens through an IPO. An initial public offering. That's when a private company sells shares to the public for the very first time, usually to raise money.
And what happens to the price then?
Well, if lots of people want to buy those new shares high demand, the price can shoot up right after the IPO.
Yeah.
But if a company that's already public issues more shares, that can actually push the price down if demand doesn't increase to soak up the extra supply.
Oh, supply and demand. The basics.
Always comes back to that.
Book also really pushed the importance of price charts. Why are they so useful? What do they actually show us?
They compare charts to roadmaps. They give you a visual history of how a stock's price has moved and often how many shares were traded, the volume, over a certain time.
So you can see the past trends.
Yeah, you can see if it's generally been going up, down, sideways. You can spot big, rapid changes. You can also easily compare how one stock is doing versus another or versus the whole market, like the S&P 500.
And these charts are the basis for timing indicators.
Exactly. Those indicators are tools, often based on chart data, that try to give you signals about when to buy or sell. You know, like an OHLC chart, open, high, low, close, that shows the day's trading range. That gives you a quick snapshot of the buyer versus seller battle for the day.
Timing indicators. Trying to get the entry and exit right. Where do these ideas even come from?
It's actually fascinating. The book mentions the earliest forms go way back to like 17th century Japanese rice markets.
Wow, really? Rice markets?
Yeah. And over the centuries, tons of different techniques developed. The book highlights that OHLC bar chart we just mentioned as a really fundamental one to understand. It packs a lot of info, the open, high, low, close prices for the period, into one simple bar.
Okay. But with all these charts and indicators getting complex, the book also talked about simplicity. That seems counterintuitive.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But they made a strong case for keeping your approach simple.
Why? What are the benefits?
Several things. First, your method is clear. You
actually
understand it. Second, you avoid spending money on super complicated, maybe overpriced systems. Third, fewer decisions usually mean less chance of getting overwhelmed or making mistakes.
Less analysis paralysis.
Right. Fourth, it generally takes less work to manage. And fifth, less to learn means less to forget or mess up. They mentioned Nicholas Darvis and his simple box trading method as an example of something effective but straightforward.
So find a clear method, test it, stick to it, focus on the essentials.
That's the idea. Don't get lost in complexity for complexity's sake.
Okay. Now, we mentioned it earlier, but let's dig into margin trading again. Borrowing money from your broker. What's the deal? The good and the bad.
Right, margin. So you borrow money to trade bigger. If there's a 50% margin rule, your $10,000 could control $20,000 worth of stock.
The upside. Bigger potential profits.
If you're yes, your gains are amplified. But, and this is the critical part, your losses are amplified just as much.
Ouch.
Yeah. And it's not free money. You pay interest on what you borrow, which eats into any profits. And the biggest risk, a margin call.
What's that? Sounds bad.
It is. If the value of the stocks you bought on margin drops too low, below a certain maintenance level,
your broker calls you up.
They demand more money from you immediately. What? Or they can just force sell your stocks, often at the worst possible time, to cover the loan without even asking you.
Wow. So you could lose more than your initial investment.
Absolutely. It's a very powerful tool, but extremely risky. Definitely not for beginners, and even experienced traders need to be super careful. You'd watch things like your margin utilization or your margin stocks dropping hard. Those are red flags.
The double-edged sword indeed. Okay, another interesting point the book made was challenging that old saying, buy low, sell high. What was their alternative view?
Yeah, they questioned if buying really cheap stocks is always the best or easiest way. They actually argued you might have a better chance of making consistent money by focusing on more stable, higher-priced stocks.
Higher-priced stocks, why?
Because those stocks often make smaller but maybe more predictable percentage moves. They used a baseball analogy, aiming for consistent base hits instead of trying to hit risky home runs all the time.
So small, steady gains add up.
That was their point. A 10% gain on a $50 stock, $5 move, might be easier and less stressful to achieve than trying to get a $5 gain on a $2 stock, which would be a huge, volatile 250% jump. Stability over speculation.
Interesting perspective. Base hits versus home runs. Okay. The book also had a glossary, right? Highlighting the importance of just knowing the lingo.
Definitely. Terms like dollars per share, lot, margin call, OHLC chart.
Yeah.
You really need to understand the vocabulary to know what's going on, talk to a broker, or even read analysis properly. It's foundational.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move into picking stocks. The do's and don'ts. They started this section with another one of those analogies, didn't they? The jungle.
Yes, the market is a jungle. Survival of the fittest. They talked about the big players, the institutions as lions and tigers.
Yeah.
Powerful, lots of capital.
And the small individual investor.
The speedy monkeys.
Yeah.
Nimble, maybe clever, but with much less capital. So the book was aimed at helping those monkeys succeed by being smart and strategic, not by trying to overpower the lion.
Using agility instead of brute force. Makes sense. And a big don't was that herd mentality again, right? Monkey see, monkey do.
Exactly. That impulse to just copy what everyone else is doing, it often leads you to buy high because everyone's excited and then sell low in a panic when the crowd gets scared.
Yeah, fear of missing out, then panic selling. Not a winning combo.
Rarely works out well. You see it even today with things like meme stocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prices get totally detached from reality because of social media hype. Pure monkey see, monkey do.
Definitely. So with thousands of stocks out there, where does a market monkey even begin to look? How do you narrow it down?
Good question. They suggested starting with lists like most actives, the stocks trading the most shares, which you find in financial pacers or websites, sometimes called big movers or top volume.
Okay, so look where the action is.
Yeah, and also winners and losers list stocks with the biggest percentage gains or losses. That gives you a starting pool. They mentioned stock screens, too, where you filter by criteria, but said those can be tricky for beginners.
So start with the active lists, but then what? Just buy them?
No, that's just step one, finding potential names. The crucial next step is research. Dig into those companies. They actually recommended making a list, maybe 10 or 20 stocks, and just tracking them for a while. Don't jump in.
Let the unripe bananas ripen, as they say.
Exactly. Avoid emotional, impulsive buys. Do your homework first.
What about those hot stocks lists you see everywhere, promising the next big thing. Should we just follow those?
They advised caution there. Sure, some sectors get hot tech and medical were big back then and they can offer fast growth, but
there's always a but.
Yeah, they usually come with way more volatility and risk. Traditional industries might be slower, maybe more stable. The point was, don't just chase the hype. Apply your research methods within those hot sectors if you want, but understand the risks.
Okay, let's break down those hot sectors a bit. What made something a tech stock back in 2002, according to the book?
Tech stocks were usually seen as high growth potential, often recent IPOs. Think computer makers, semiconductor companies, telecom, internet stuff, software. They could be on the NYSE, which had stricter earnings rules, or NASDAQ, which was often seen as more focused on future growth, maybe more speculative.
And medical stocks, similar story.
Pretty similar, yeah. Also known for volatility, big potential wins and losses. You had established drug companies on the NYSE, but also cutting-edge biotech firms, often on NASDAQ.
Biotech? That sounds particularly risky.
It was, and still is.
Yeah.
Developing new drugs based on gene tech involves long timelines, huge uncertainty with clinical trials, regulatory hurdles. Prices could swing wildly on news. Very high risk, high reward potential.
Got it. And IPOs themselves, we mentioned them. Often lots of hype. What was the book's main advice there?
They walk through, the process company gets an underwriter, they market at price, it allocate shares, often favoring big clients. But the big warning was, IPOs are inherently super risky because there's no real price history to look at. It's brand new to the market. Plus, the first few hours or days of trading can be really emotional and chaotic.
Mm.
People make impulsive decisions.
So the advice was?
Be extremely careful. Do your own research. Look beyond the hype. Don't get swept up in the excitement. Maybe even wait a while. Let the dust settle. See how the company performs as a public entity before jumping in.
Independent research. Avoid the frenzy. Seems like a recurring theme. Okay, let's talk brokers, the people who actually place the trades for you or the platforms you use. What did the book say about choosing one?
It pointed out brokers aren't all the same. Some just take orders, others give advice, some are more like salespeople. The first big choice is online discount broker or traditional full-service broker.
What's the difference?
Online or discount, brokers generally have much lower commissions, but less personal contact or advice. Full-service brokers offer advice, planning, but usually cost more. The book mentioned looking in newspapers, online directories like Yahoo Finance back then to find options.
So when you're looking at, say, an online broker, what are the key things to check?
Minimum account size you need to open or keep, commission rates, and really read the fine print. The advertised rate might not be what you actually pay for all types of trades.
Good tip. What else?
What services they offer? Real-time quotes, phone trading if your internet's down,
yeah.
Research tools, other perks. But then they asked a good question.
Which was?
Do you actually need all the fancy extras? Sometimes too much info is just distracting. And remember, brokers make money when you trade. So the book really pushed for making your own decisions based on your research, not just relying on the broker.
Right. So full service versus discount. What are the potential conflicts with a full service broker giving advice?
Well, they use that funny analogy. Use treehouse salespeople. The concern is they might push investments that benefit the firm, maybe a recent IPO they underwrote, or a stock the firm owns a lot of, rather than what's truly best for you.
And you pay more for that potentially biased advice.
Usually, yeah. Higher commissions, especially if they suggested the trade, a solicited trade. Discount brokers are cheaper, better if you make your own calls. Banks also offer services, often somewhere in the middle.
So the overall message about brokers was basically, be aware.
Totally. Be aware. No guarantee advice from a big firm is good advice.
Yeah.
Look at the dot-com bust.
Mm-hmm.
Brokerages want you to trade. That's how they earn. There can be conflicts of interest, especially if they're underwriting the stocks they recommend. Big clients might get better info or IPO access.
But you pay for that access with higher fees and potential pressure.
Exactly. Know the dynamics. Do your own thinking. That was the core message.
Okay. Let's switch to trading the cheapies. Stocks under $10. What was the book's take on these? Are they automatically less risky?
No, definitely not. They shot down that idea right away. A low price doesn't mean low risk, just like a high price doesn't guarantee quality. They said you need to look deeper, starting with volume.
Trading volume, the number of shares traded daily. Why is that so important for cheap stocks?
Because high volume means lots of interest and, crucially, liquidity. You can usually buy or sell easily near the current price. Low volume. That's a red flag.
Why?
It means few people are trading it. It might be hard to sell your shares when you want to, or you might have to accept a much lower price than you expected just to get out. Lack of liquidity is a major risk, especially in cheap stocks. They use a funny Funky Monkey Candy Corp example to make the point.
Okay, so volume matters for liquidity. What else should you look at beyond the price chart for these cheapies?
You absolutely need to understand the business itself. What do they do? What industry? Who are their competitors? While pure technical traders might ignore this, the book argued that for any kind of sustainable investing, especially with cheap stocks, you need to know the fundamentals.
And be wary of hype if you didn't find it yourself.
Yeah. They basically said if you're hearing a hot tip about a cheap stock you never researched, you might be the last person to hear about it. The easy money might already be gone, but the risk is still there.
Good point. They also mentioned number of outstanding shares. How does that fit in?
Outstanding shares, that's the total number of shares the company has issued. For cheap stocks, sometimes a lower number of outstanding shares can be interesting.
Why lower?
Because with fewer shares available, a smaller float, any increase in buying demand can potentially push the price up faster. More bang for the buck, potentially. They suggested comparing the number to competitors or widely held stocks to see if it's relatively small or large. You can find this info easily on finance websites.
Okay. What about institutional ownership and short interest? How do those apply to cheap stocks?
Right. Institutional ownership is the percentage owned by big players, funds, pensions, banks. High ownership could be a good sign, suggesting smart money sees value. But if those big institutions decide to sell, they can crush the price of a small, cheap stock really fast. Short interest is the amount of shares bet against the stock, expecting the price to fall.
High short interest is bad then?
Not always. It can set up a short squeeze. If the price starts rising unexpectedly, those short sellers have to buy back shares to cut their losses. That buying pressure can push the price up even faster. A short covering rally. They mentioned Priceline.com as an example back then.
Interesting. And finally, they used that term sex appeal for cheap stocks. What's that about?
Yeah. Sex appeal just means investing in whatever industry is currently hot or trendy, capturing everyone's imagination. Railroads way back, then semiconductors.coms.
What was hot when the book was written?
Biotech. Tech generally, energy. They suggested you could apply your other stock picking methods within these sexy sectors. But they warned that what's hot changes fast. Today's darling is tomorrow's dog.
Okay, so you find a cheap stock you like, considering all this. How should you actually buy or sell it? Any specific order types recommended?
Yes, very specifically. Use limit orders, not market orders.
Yeah.
Especially for low-volume stocks or anything under maybe $7.
Why limit order?
A market order just gets you the best available price right now. In a thin or volatile cheap stock, that price could be way different from what you saw a second ago. A limit order lets you set your maximum buy price or minimum sell price. More control.
That seems crucial for cheap stocks.
Absolutely. They also stress factoring in commission costs. Since commissions are a bigger percentage of a cheap stock trade, you need a decent price move just to break even, let alone profit. And they generally warn beginners away from penny stocks, usually under $1, too volatile, too easily manipulated.
What about funds?
They did mention low-price mutual funds as an option for diversification if you have limited capital but want exposure to cheaper assets. The main takeaway for cheap stocks was combine factors like volume and outstanding shares, use limit orders, and watch those commissions.
Right. Okay, we've covered finding stocks. Now, the technical approach, using charts and indicators to predict prices. The book seemed a bit skeptical here.
Yeah, they started with a pretty strong caution. They acknowledged people use timing indicators, but said many are basically useless, no better than flipping a coin.
Ouch. So all those lines on charts might not mean much.
Their concern was that popular books often don't show how ineffective many indicators are. They don't quantify the results.
So instead of just picking random indicators, what did they suggest?
A systematic approach. Choose a trading system, a clear set of rules for buying and selling, and follow it consistently, even if it's not perfect.
Why is the system approach better?
Because if you follow rules, it's easier to see if the system is flawed rather than wondering if you messed up because you traded on emotion. They also distinguish between lagging indicators, like moving averages that confirm a trend after it starts.
And leading indicators that try to predict the future.
Right. Lagging indicators can get you in and out late if you're not careful or don't combine them with other things.
Moving averages, MAs, are super common. How do they work in the system context?
Well, in an MA, averages past prices over a set period, like 50 days. A basic signal is price closes above the MA, maybe a buy. Price closes below, maybe a sell. Or you can look at crossovers, like a short-term MA crossing above a long-term one.
But they lag, right?
They do, because they're based on the past. They work best when a strong trend is already established, helping you ride it. But in choppy, sideways markets, they can give lots of false signals, whip you back and forth.
So price above the MA generally means uptrend, below means downtrend.
That's the general idea. And there are different ways to calculate them, simple, weighted, exponential, which react slightly differently to recent prices.
They also mentioned MACD. What's that again?
MACD Moving Average Convergence, Divergence. It shows the relationship between two different moving averages. You get buy signals when the MACD line crosses above its signal line, and sell signals when it crosses below.
Another timing tool.
Yeah, and the book mentioned it could also help spot support and resistance levels, which they plan to cover later. Again, the idea isn't just blind faith in the signal, but understanding what it's showing about momentum.
What about just looking at chart patterns visually, like head and shoulders or triangles?
They discuss chart patterns too. The plus side, you don't always need a computer. They're relatively easy to learn. And sometimes there's a psychological logic behind them.
At the downside.
Huge subjectivity. Two traders can look at the same chart and see different patterns. And it's really hard to statistically test if they actually work reliably. Experts often disagree too, especially with complex stuff like Dan or Elliott Wave.
So the book's advice.
Use patterns, maybe. But combine them with more objective, rule-based indicators to confirm things. Don't rely only on subjective patterns.
Any other indicators mentioned?
Briefly, yeah. Parabolic SAR, which gives trailing stop points. Momentum indicators, which measure the speed of price changes as the trend accelerating or slowing down.
Yeah.
And accumulation distribution.
Accumulation distribution? What's that?
It's trying to figure out if smart money is quietly buying, accumulating near bottoms, or selling off distributing near tops. Are the bulls taking control, or are the bears unloading onto unsuspecting buyers?
Trying to follow the smart money.
That's the idea.
So pulling it all together, what makes an effective stock trading system, according to the book?
It needs clear rules. What to trade, when exactly to buy, when exactly to sell, and crucially, how to manage risk, stop losses, position size. They argued a complete system gives you a better shot than just using individual indicators randomly.
And it should incorporate support and resistance.
Yeah. They define support as a level where buying stops a downtrend in an uptrend context, and resistance where selling stops an uptrend in a downtrend context.
Yeah.
But they warn that just finding these levels isn't enough. You need to know the main trend direction, too. Using trend lines is common, but again, often subjective.
Okay. Let's switch back to a simpler strategy popular with long-term folks. Dollar cost averaging, DCA. What was the book's take on this?
They called DCA, or scale trading, spaced repetition, a strategy based on optimism, really. The idea is simple. Invest a fixed amount of money regularly, like every month, into a stock or fund, no matter the price.
So you buy more shares when it's cheap, fewer when it's expensive.
Exactly. It averages out your cost over time. They said it works well long term if you pick good quality investments that won't go bust or just flatline forever. For people worried about timing the market, it's often more about reducing that anxiety.
Yeah, took the guesswork out. What are the key rules for doing DCA properly?
Regular intervals, stick to your schedule. Long-term view, don't expect instant results. Fixed dollar amount, usually, maybe increasing it over time. Some variations involve buying more aggressively below a certain price or having a plan to take profits or use stops.
And best suited for?
Typically best when markets have been falling, letting you average down. And usually applied to solid, established blue-chip stocks or broad market funds with a history of profitability.
Okay. Now, back to support and resistance. The book introduced a specific technique, the MAC, Moving Average Channel. What's that about?
Right, the MAC. So, building on support, where buyers step in and resistance, where sellers take over, the challenge is making it objective. How do you know where support or resistance really is and if the trend is up or down?
The MAC tries to answer that.
That's what they presented it as, a specific way to use moving averages to create a channel or bands around the KEIS. The idea is these channel lines act as dynamic support and resistance levels.
So you'd look to buy near the bottom line in an uptrend, sell near the top line in a downtrend.
That's the general concept. They showed examples across different stocks and timeframes. Weekly, daily, intraday, claiming it helps identify the trend, its strength, and potential turning points. But they did say it requires some judgment, it's not purely mechanical. Think of it like guide rails for the price.
The book then gave two real-time examples of trades. Tell us about those. What was the point?
Yeah, two trades the author actually did. First was FCEL, bought based on moving average signals, saw it moving up. Crucially, Use a 15% trailing stop loss to lock in profit as it rose, rather than waiting for a lagging MA sell signal. Had a clear profit target, too.
And the second trade?
PCLN, Priceline. Bought it, basically hoping the NASDAQ would bounce back after a crash. No clear target, less defined entry reason. It made money, but the author felt it was less successful as a trade.
Why? Because it wasn't well planned.
Exactly. The FCL trade had vision, a clear plan, risk management. The PCLN trade was more impulsive, less structured. The lesson was, a clear plan with defined goals and risk control is vital, even if a less planned trade sometimes works out by luck.
Planning matters more than luck in the long run.
Okay.
Then they discussed implementing market strategies using a China train example.
Right. This one showed using momentum and moving averages for signals. Interestingly, the author admitted buying 2 days after the signal, waiting for confirmation.
So not blindly following the system.
Kind of. It showed using common sense alongside the system. And near the profit target, instead of just putting in a sell order, they actively managed it, watching the short-term action. The point was teaching working methods, not perfect theories. No system is 100%. You need judgment and goals, too.
They also revisited DCA, but for mutual funds specifically, what was the nuance there?
The timing. How and when you DCA into funds matters. They compared just investing regularly, like clockwork, versus maybe using technical indicators or market outlook to time your DCA investments slightly better.
So a more active DCA.
Potentially. Investing less often, say bi-quarterly, is easier. But they suggested a more diligent approach, guided by a long-term view and maybe some timing indicators, might boost returns over just automatic investing.
Okay. We've hit strategies, tools, but then there's a whole chapter on discipline. Why is that so important? More important than the system itself, they argued.
Yeah, they really hammered this point. You can have the best strategy in the world, but if you don't follow it consistently, it's useless. Discipline, they argued, is often the deciding factor in the long run.
And how did they define trading discipline?
Simply acting on your system signals and following your risk rules, basically. Can you stick to your plan?
How do you know if your discipline is lacking?
Ask yourself, are my real results matching what my system should be doing? Am I making money when the system says I should? Am I losing when it suggests profit? Am I deviating from the plan because of fear or greed? If your results are worse than the system's potential, discipline is likely the culprit.
So you need to analyze your losses.
Meticulously. Was it the system or did I break the rules? Emotion, error, disorganization. Trace every step. Discipline is the rudder. Without it, the best ship drifts. Learning discipline comes first.
Makes sense. Finally, caveat emptor, computerized trading systems, black boxes promising profits. What was the warning?
Huge skepticism needed. They told a story about someone, Roger, losing big with a supposedly high probability automated system. It highlighted that back-tested results can look great, but reality might be different. Hidden flaws.
So don't just trust the marketing.
Definitely not. Ask tough questions. Promoters use clever wording and disclaimers. Buyer beware. Backtesting can be flawed too.
How so?
Curve fitting. Optimizing a system so it looks perfect on past data. But the future isn't the past. It might fail miserably in live trading. Proper testing isn't just about finding the best past results. It's about understanding risk, drawdowns, what might really work going forward.
What should you look for in testing claims?
How many years of data were used? Longer is better. Suspicious if it's only a few recent years. How many trades in the back test? More is better for statistical significance. And ask about real-world cost fees, slippage. What was the worst losing streak?
Sure.
Drawdown.
Got it. Be very, very skeptical of automated promises. And the book wrapped up with a glossary.
Yeah, just reinforcing that knowing the terms bear market, bull market, liquidity, volatility, technical analysis is absolutely crucial. You need to speak the language.
Well, that really was a deep dive into stock market strategies that work. It feels like becoming that successful market chimp is about more than just knowing stuff. Oh, absolutely. It's knowledge, yes. Having the right tools, yes. But like we just discussed, it's maybe even more about discipline, psychology, managing yourself.
And that constant theme. Think for yourself, do your own research. Don't just follow tips or hype.
Exactly. Critical thinking is non-negotiable in the market jungle.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. As you look at your own approach, think about that balance, the excitement of those volatile, hot stocks versus the perhaps slower, steadier path of really well-researched, maybe less glamorous investments. Where do you want to be on that spectrum? Something you want. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.